How did you get interested in this subject?
I got interested in this subject, and it's actually kind of a personal story. I struggle with anxiety and depression, and I have my whole life. And when I was in my, and I will spare you the grisly details, I fell into a really bad one in 2007. And I knew vaguely about cognitive behavioral therapy prior to this. But I started practicing cognitive behavioral therapy. And the amazing thing about cognitive behavioral therapy is, it takes a lot of work. And you have to basically do it constantly, and you have to do it, you have to write it down, and you have to practice it. But then it almost sort of snuck up on me and it took maybe 9 months. But I remember 9 months after this, after I'd been in like the I'm not going to make it out of it kind of stage, I was happy because I was talking back to the voices in my own head. So meanwhile, I'm going about my work on college campuses, and I'm watching some of these really sort of what might even be considered sort of like almost funny, kind of like exaggerated free speech cases. And I looked at them and I said, my goodness, we're actually teaching a generation. We're modeling the behavior of cognitive distortions to a generation of students. We should expect them to be depressed and anxious if they're actually listening. But at the time, it was primarily, I thought, administrators who were teaching, who were modeling these lessons. And I'm afraid that students are actually learning them. So it came from a very personal place, but that got expanded into becoming friends with Jonathan Haidt, becoming friends with a lot of social psychologists, reading a lot of social psychology. And the more I looked into it, the more I started to think, wow, so campuses are based, seem to be basing a lot of their philosophy on how we talk to each other on a model of humanity that means we don't benefit from difficult experiences. We don't benefit from discomfort, that we're very, very fragile. And none of this is not what modern psychology says. It generally says things that really run counter to that. And certainly if you were to go to a psychologist and they were to say, you're broken forever, they would lose their job. So this article was a first sort of attempt to address what I think are not just, you know, bad sort of pseudo-psychology being practiced on campus, but what I think might even be harmful psychological lessons that we're teaching a generation.
So if you don't mind me asking, I mean, what kind of pushback did you get after coming out with that?
You know, I'd say the surprising thing was, given that, you know, I work on college campuses and I've been doing this for defending free speech on college campuses for 15 years. You know, most of that time has been butting heads with administrators for the most part. But in the last 2 years, I've been disturbed to see that a lot more of it seems to be coming from students. And definitely I've watched as topics, you know, particularly if you talk about trigger warnings, particularly if you're critical of them, or you talk about microaggressions, or you're critical of the theory, that's a very radioactive thing to say. So I was expecting a ton of hate mail as soon as the article came out. It didn't really happen at first. You know, we did get criticized, but for the most part, when I'd be doing NPR shows or I'd be doing radio anywhere, I'd get usually at least one professor call in and say, yeah, I'm worried. I'm walking on eggshells, or someone tweet that out. I'd say that since the first time I said that in an Atlantic article, there's been more pushback, but it's primarily been, frankly, kind of non-responsive. It's mostly been, well, I like trigger warnings. And it's like, but that's not what we're saying. It's perfectly fine to like them. But what we're saying is really think this through. First of all, is there research indicating that they work? And there isn't. But that's understandable because the phenomena is so new. But if you look at other research about how you deal with people who have PTSD or you deal with people who have trauma, there's nothing out there that says, oh, and by all means, tell them that they're broken forever and that there's nothing that can be done and really walk on eggshells around them. For the most part, therapists actually say the exact opposite. So it's been interesting watching some of the pushback. I just did a program at Irvine on microaggressions that was interesting, where one of the deans, I think, at UC Irvine was claiming that microaggression theory was based on decades of research. And meanwhile, I would really like to see what this research is when, you know, everything that, you know, John Haidt and I have studied and looked into, or people like Richard McNally at Harvard have looked into, says that, you know, if you really magnify tiny unconscious slights, you're setting yourself up for a lifetime of misery, essentially.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it really started the conversation among a lot of professor friends of mine. I mean, your article gave voice to something that they've long suspected. But I got to ask, I mean, is this any different from what was happening in the early 90s? I mean, people talk about the new PC movement, but what's new about that?
I do think it's new, because I think that the PC movement of the late 80s, early 90s, you know, was probably the last time you saw this sort of like crusading zeal around sort of speech policing. But I do think that the two moments were different in a lot of different ways. And there definitely was a powerful underpinning of empowerment in the 80s and 90s. You know, if you when conservatives would say, oh, this is playing victimology, you get a very strong response like, no, we're not saying that people are victims. We're not saying that people are fragile. We're saying we're trying to prevent actual discrimination. We're trying to challenge the canon to make the canon more inclusive. Whereas now that's still there to a degree. But this time around, it has a very strong sort of psychological, sort of what I actually go so far to call pseudo-psychological underpinning, that is based in sort of ideas of human fragility and also what you're supposed to do in the face of human fragility, that I personally think, and as I explained in the article along with John Haidt, is poorly thought out.
And so you're basically saying that this new PC movement kind of already assumes that people are victims and need
yes.
to be protected.
Yes, it does. I think that's exactly right. And I think that it runs the risk of becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's interesting because right now, you know, and I got challenged in the pages of The Atlantic by someone saying, oh, it's just another old dude saying it was harder in his day. And I was like, well, okay, if you want to dismiss the argument like that, that goes into sort of like the grand canon of sort of ways we just get out of having to have meaningful arguments. But I'm going to take this on its face. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, your great-grandmother had it harder than us at virtually every level. And so a lot of sort of ancient wisdom comes from dealing with tremendous adversity, and at least partially the recognition that as your comfort sort of increases, the more narrowly focused you can be on smaller things. And one thing that I just find fascinating, one of the things that that I talk about when it comes to microaggressions is the idea of when I talked about this at UC Irvine, there was an idea that, well, you know, we don't, and even the people were advocates of it, saying we don't see as much overt racism, so we have to go after these tiny unconscious things. And while I definitely support the study of all of these things, whether they're trigger warnings or microaggressions, when you take it to the next level and start being very normative about it, this is the way people should talk to each other, you run into some serious problems, particularly if your argument is being sort of multicultural, being culturally sensitive. Because what you end up doing, and I was pointing this out when I was at Stanford in the late 90s, every time you decide that we're going to language police, not coincidentally, you end up taking on the values of what are often very affluent, Ivy League, educated people, the way they think you should talk. And I'd always point out there's fundamental contradictions in this. This is very sort of America-centric. This is very sort of like Ivy League-centric. And this is and I'd also always point out, this also starts sounding incredibly classist to me. This sounds like the old Victorian kind of like, well, you know, educated people only speak this way. And I remember being in a human rights class hearing some of these opinions espoused, having just come from working in refugee camps and in factories and with inner city high school kids in D.C. and in restaurants since I was a little kid. And I was like, do you even like the people that you're saying that you're protecting?
Well, one thing I really loved about the article you wrote with Jonathan Haidt is you basically talked about how this new PC movement reinforced some kind of faulty logic. Could you go into some of that?
Sure. I mean, the thing that was sort of fun for me in the article was to finally get on paper something I've been thinking for years. And, you know, I'm a First Amendment lawyer, so obviously, you know, my bias is completely with freedom of speech and constitutional law and that kind of stuff. But since I work on campuses, the thing that I really noticed, and as I mentioned before, most of my career has been administrators overreacting to things. So most of my thinking about the article came from that context. And the main thing that administrators have been doing for a really long time that I actually initially placed first in the article is what's known in cognitive behavioral therapy as the cognitive distortion of catastrophizing, which is essentially to take any small thing and act like it's an incredible emergency. And I give an example, you know, of this case just from last year at a college in New Jersey, where they suspended a professor And they sent him to mandatory psychological counseling because he posted a picture of his daughter on Google Plus wearing a Game of Thrones T-shirt. And the Game of Thrones T-shirt is Khaleesi saying, "I will take what is mine with fire and blood." Now, again, this is a picture of his daughter he posted on an obscure site that barely anybody uses. But because an administrator got an email of this, he immediately interpreted this, and it's just bizarre looking at the language, as a threat upon the entire community.
Really? Huh.
Yeah.
How can you read that out of that one statement?
I see this all the time. It's partially the consequence of zero tolerance. And I see universities taking this, you know, better safe than sorry to a ridiculous extreme. You see this on K through 12 too. You know, like all those ridiculous stories of, you know, the kid who bit the Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun being suspended. I mean, like there's a story like that almost every day.
So what's at the root of all of this? I mean, how come students today are unwilling or uncomfortable tolerating different ideas?
I think overall, the problem that we're currently facing, and I think we really need to understand this, these are these are negative outcomes of otherwise very positive things. Even, you know, the much maligned political correctness. I tend to agree with Steve Pinker that it comes from
it's well-intentioned in nature.
Yeah, that it's well-intentioned and that it's sort of part of, you know, an anti-discrimination movement that takes on some at times kind of absurd manifestations. But I also think that essentially the more affluent a society becomes, the more able they are to live in communities that reflect their values, the more they're able just to get their information from sources that confirm their points of view, and the more they're able to sort of insulate themselves even from physical pain, that people get less able to handle conflict. And I think that so I refer to this actually in a book I wrote called Freedom from Speech as a problem of comfort. It's the kind of thing that you can take the partisan lens entirely off of it, because I think that essentially this is the kind of problem that you will face as things get better. It's kind of like obesity. Like the more availability of calories you have, the more you can kind of expect people to run into this problem over and over again of being overweight and the health costs that come with that. I think this is sort of the dark side of the fact that we have so many of these amazing advantages that we don't or aren't quite as trained at disagreeing in productive ways.
Well, can you give me a few examples of how this plays out on college campuses?
Oh, I have so many. I wrote a book called Unlearning Liberty that's just filled with examples of this. I have a website, thefire.org. You know, at this point, I've seen thousands of examples. I could, you know, we have hundreds of examples on the website with full documentation. But I'll talk about what case is going on right now at Wesleyan, right this very moment. The student government is considering defunding the student newspaper because they ran an article that was critical of the tactics of the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, this wasn't an inflammatory article. This is something that would have fit in on USA Today or mainstream publication, and it would have been perfectly. And I didn't agree with all of it, but at the same time, it would have been perfectly well answered with another op-ed. But instead, this led immediately to not just protests, but a very proud declaration that students were going to start, quote-unquote, recycling copies of the student newspaper until their demands were met or until the Argus, the name of the newspaper, was defunded. And they had a big meeting about it. The student government had a big meeting about it just this past weekend. And they decided they can't make up their mind about whether or not to defund the Argus, so they're going to put it off for another week. And this is, you know, one of these things. I've seen different versions of this my entire career, but the thing that made it somewhat different was just the pride with which the students were talking about what amounted to newspaper destruction because it ran an article they didn't like. And again, it would have been very well addressed by someone actually just writing a competing op-ed, which, by the way, the newspaper was very clear. If you want to submit an op-ed contradicting this, you want to submit 10. That's great. But are you really saying that we're not supposed to ever run an article that might actually anger the politics of this university? And I think increasingly the example, particularly when you look at the phenomenon like disinvitation season, the tendency to want to get speakers who people disagree with disinvited from campus, that the answer scarily seems to be, at least right now, yes.
So far you've been talking about trigger warnings and microaggressions. Could you briefly define what both are and even go into like where trigger warnings come from, where the concept comes from?
Yeah, okay. I'll probably start with microaggressions. Microaggressions I actually find really interesting, and I think they're a very interesting thing to study. And what they are usually unconscious, unintentional, racist, sexist, or otherwise discriminatory slights. They're described by a Princeton website as the paper guts of oppression. You know, so the perfect example of it in terms of one that is, you know, sympathetic and you'd understand why you would consider that a microaggression, you know, it's often cited, is, for example, someone who just can't stop emphasizing how articulate an African-American student is. Now, that is insulting, and because it implies the idea that this is a surprise. And so for those kind of microaggressions, I definitely understand where this comes from. But the problem with when you change it from something to be studied into something to be policed, it starts taking on some very strange forms. So at the UC system, there's a policy, applicable, I think, at most of the UC schools right now, that define microaggressions as including statements like, "I think the person who has the most merit should get the job." Saying that affirmative action is racist would count as a microaggression. Saying that America's a melting pot was another one that they listed as an example of a microaggression. And when I talked to someone at UC, they were saying, well, you know, you can't actually be brought up on charges of this policy. And I'm like, hold on. You're declaring that it's a tiny form of violence against oppressed people to make these oftentimes political arguments, sometimes things that people say without even thinking about them, and that doesn't have any effect on the way professors teach. I think that's just absolutely disingenuous. Hmm. You're obviously establishing an orthodoxy, saying that nobody can say that, you know, again, affirmative action is racist or that America is a melting pot. And also, there's the question of how exactly did we get here from microaggressions? So the other university that recently sort of struggled with this, they didn't exactly call these microaggressions. They just referred to it as problematic language. But it was at University of New Hampshire, and they gave their list of problematic words to use. And it got a lot of attention, particularly in conservative media, because it one of the things that they listed was American. And I'm used to people being critical of using American to describe people from the U.S. because, you know, people from South America think of themselves American, too. So that was one where I was at least used to that one. But there were so many other examples that they used of microaggressions that I found really much more troubling, including the term Arab. They didn't even bother to sort of explain, you know, who this is troubling to. I think maybe they were assuming that if you apply it to someone who actually isn't Arabic, but they just used Arab as a term. And to me, it's just like it shows how dunderheaded some of this stuff can be, because, you know, there was a great episode of The Office in which Michael Scott ham-fistedly tries to deal with diversity issues. And then when Oscar explains, you know, how he self-describes, well, he's like, well, I'm Mexican. And, you know, Michael Scott's response is, well, is there a less offensive term that we could use? And that's what I feel like they did at University of New Hampshire. It's like my vice president of my organization is half Arab. And the idea that the most offensive idea was the idea that his self-description could be offensive.
Those examples seem so benign. But I'm wondering, yep. I mean, where does this even come from? I mean, where does this compulsion to call people out on this type of stuff? I mean, what's at the root of that?
You know, I don't know, but I definitely do think that there's a lot of groupthink going on campus. And I definitely think there's a lot of myopia. I mean, when I go on, I went on this sort of old school, and this is kind of how I self-describe, sort of old school ACLU type. And I went on this old school ACLU type radio show up in New York a couple weeks ago. And they were so frustrated with the examples we were talking about, because they were like, well, you know, there's all sorts of really serious things going on in the world. And it seems like that even though I think the students have the best of intentions in some cases when they're trying to police language on campus, it sort of distracts from the idea of like, well, what are we going to do about police militarization? What are we going to do about Syrian refugees? They're very serious stuff. So I think I think it partially comes from the fact that, you know, you end up having pretty politically homogeneous environments on campus. And even to the degree that they're not, we've created a situation in which, partially through speech policing, we're encouraging people just to talk to the people they already agree with. And if there's one, you know, you should always be somewhat suspicious of social science, but if there's one experiment that's incredibly easy to recreate, you can recreate it just with different colored T-shirts, is how quickly people can sort of polarize, so suddenly to think of someone as an in-group and an out-group, and how once that decision has been made about about how much more extreme people can get in their political positions when you do it through a political lens. So I think you see sort of a sort of absurd and exaggerated sort of microcosm of what's happening in our larger society on our campuses, where we've become stuck sort of in our echo chambers and increasingly angry over smaller things, which is bad in its own right and problematic in its own right. But what really troubles me is I think it also takes us away from thinking about things that, you know, can actually be fixed or can actually help people who are genuinely suffering from, you know, what might be called macroaggressions.
Well, and you also make the point, though, in the article that this is a generational shift that mm-hmm. also stems out of how, you know, today's college students were raised.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We do talk about a lot about where this comes from the point of view of where people are raised. And again, it's one of those things where I see it as a negative consequence of an otherwise positive thing. People having the ability to spend more time with their kids, to be the ability to be a helicopter parent is actually sort of like a wonderful thing. The fact that we are, though, has some pretty serious negative consequences. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing such high rates of depression and anxiety on what should otherwise be considered possibly the most affluent generation that's ever graced the planet is partially just we're reaping what we've sown. We're telling students, we're telling a generation, frankly, you're not competent, you're very fragile. If something bad happens, you'll be damaged forever, you won't bounce back, you'll be broken, essentially. And then we're shocked that we have anxious and depressed students. And what we tried to do in this article is sort of the first attempt to introduce some of what psychology actually says about ways to be happy, about ways to fight anxiety and fight depression. And one of them is to address your interior dialogue rationally. And I think this is an insight that is not sufficiently appreciated, that one of the best interventions we've ever discovered for dealing with anxiety and depression is simply to look at your own thoughts and ask yourself, is this a mental exaggeration, also known as a cognitive distortion? And the step that we took in the Atlantic article was very simple. We just said, these things will make you depressed and anxious if you engage in these sort of exaggerated thoughts, if you direct them inward. But for some reason, we're teaching students that it's okay to direct them outward, but then watching a generation of with really high rates of anxiety and depression. I think we need to provide tools like this. It needs to be it needs to not be a bad thing to say. It's like, can we, you know, try to have a better, more productive, rational argument on campus? Because I think it won't just improve the quality of argument. I think it will improve the overall sort of outlook of students.
Okay. Well, I mean, you've been talking about microaggressions and trigger warnings, and for the most part, they've been really benign situations. But as you point out, they were put into place. I mean, they were well-intentioned in their origin. And so where do you draw the line? I mean, where do you draw the line between what's acceptable speech and what's harmful?
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things with my First Amendment hat on, I definitely am glad that there is no, you know, category for unprotected hate speech in the country. We have some of the strongest protections for free speech in the entire world. Where do we draw the line on campuses? I would say that I always try to bring it back to the actual circumstance I'm dealing with. I think right now sort of the cultural victory of sort of sensitivity is in a lot of ways great, that we do self-police an awful lot, and in some ways that has benefits. But I think the pendulum has gone way too far in the other direction. And the hidden cost of this, and this is something that it doesn't seem like that advanced of an idea, but ultimately it just simply is always valuable to know what people really think, and especially not just even if, but especially if it's really bad. And I think that you end up. Harvey Silverglate put it really well. He talked about how, you know, if there are Nazis in the room, I'd prefer to know who I should not turn my back to. And I think that we create this sort of false sense of security to a degree by simply, as if by policing speech, we'll somehow be fixing our society when we might not be getting at the roots of the beliefs that we disagree with. But even just beyond that, you're not really going to understand your world all that well unless you know what people really think. And I think with a sort of problem of self-censorship and people organizing just into groups that they already believe in, we've lost the idea that candor across lines of genuine difference is good, especially when it's messy.
Well, I have to go into one of the criticisms that I'm sure you've received after you wrote this article. You're basically a white guy that's telling people that they're being overly sensitive. I mean, what would you say to people that say that your position of privilege maybe makes you insensitive to some of the indignities that, you know, people of color or less advantaged people have to face on a daily basis?
Yeah. The privilege argument is definitely one of the ones that we've gotten on Twitter an awful lot. And it's really only been in the past couple of years that I start getting the why should we listen to you? You're a white guy argument. And it's funny because I used to defend campuses from when conservatives would criticize them, saying, no, they don't use, dodges to arguments like that. They don't just sort of dismiss you because you're a white male. That's a silly exaggeration. But then in the past couple of years, I've spent, a lot of time dealing with arguments. And I'd like to point out, overwhelmingly coming at first from white males, and then overwhelmingly coming just from white people. People said, why should we listen to you? You're privileged. And I think we really have to think about how we argue as a society. Are we getting to the heart of the argument? And if you watch the way privilege theory ends up getting used in the way we argue, particularly when I go back to, again, an incredibly affluent place, San Francisco, when I hang out with my friends there, and the people who tend to bring up the privilege argument, again, tend to be white, that what they're doing is, for the most part, they're only using it for arguments they disagree with. They're only saying, they're only bringing up the whiteness of a thinker if they disagree with them. If they like them, they get to keep them. So if you, and I've even heard someone defend privilege theory under the theories of David Hume, and then being like, he was a really super privileged white guy, right? And I started to realize that it's yet another technique we're using not to listen to people we disagree with. And we have, campuses are arming us with tool after tool after tool to never, ever have to listen to people who disagree with us. And I think that when you watch the way some of these arguments are deployed, they are just a perfect fortress that allows you to never accept any criticism, never accept any point of view that disagrees with you if you employ them in that way. So I end up being critical of the entire way we argue on campuses, and privilege theory is part of that.
Okay, so you're basically saying that the concept of privilege, people use it as a rhetorical device to kind of end the argument right there.
Yes.
So what can we do, practically speaking, to actually facilitate these conversations and to actually, have uncomfortable discussions?
Yeah, I'm all for the uncomfortable discussion. At NPR, Michelle yesterday actually had a great discussion about the importance of being uncomfortable. I think sometimes we try to control discussions too much, and I think that's exactly what's happening on campuses. We think that if people from different classes and different backgrounds actually talk to each other, that some kind of disaster would happen. Meanwhile, I think if you look back to a lot of, for those of us who have had really interesting cross-cultural discussions, they haven't been moderated. They've just been genuine candor across lines of what hopefully in some cases would become friendship. But I do think that training students on how to disagree productively would be fantastic. So we didn't emphasize this as much as I would have liked to in the article, but I'm a big fan of hosting Oxford-style debates, and not on stuff, not on the easy stuff. Mm-hmm. If you really want to teach people to have debates, they should go in for the controversial stuff.
Well, what would be the first debate that you would organize?
What would be the first debate that I would organize? I mean, we are actually doing a series of debates, so that's funny you should ask. We're doing one at Texas A&M that is about whether or not student athletes should be paid. So that's more of sort of sticking your toe in the water. After that, we're doing one about whether or not students should be allowed to use smart drugs, which definitely gets you into more sort of controversial territory. I think being able to take every single voting issue, for example, in the U.S., whether it's abortion, whether it's immigration, whether it's violence, whether it's police brutality, whether it's police militarization, all of these things could be great productive debates that we could do a better job of modeling. But for example, when I spoke at Harvard about 2 years ago, I had a student listen to one of my speeches because I'm a big fan of just the idea of people seeing it as a duty to seek out people with whom they disagree. I think that that's how you get some real meaningful creative progress. And this student came up to me afterwards kind of heartbroken, saying, I've been trying to put together debates on major topics here, but I keep on being told, if I want to do immigration, I can't have the other side of the argument represented. If I want to do gay marriage, they don't want to do that because we'd have to have someone who opposes gay marriage debate. And I've seen this play play out. This is played out in schools in England. This is played out at UCLA, where even when students are just trying to have debates, even if they're on the quote-unquote side of the angels, if they want to have even that other person there, in some cases, particularly in Britain right now, they're told that they can't.
Wow. Well, Greg, it was a fascinating article. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks very much for having me.